Happy New Year, listeners, from your favorite podcast, Brothers in Song. And Happy New Year to you, Joe. I don't think I've had the opportunity to wish you a Happy New Year yet.
No, same to you. Happy New Year. You know, you were doing the intro, and I don't know why. I was just like, greetings, listeners, in my head. And you threw me a curveball off the bat.
I do say greetings a lot. I try to not make it the same every time, you know. So we're glad to be back, starting off our 2023 season, I guess. And to start us off, I have a question for you.
Okay.
I need you to tell me, Joe, what cringeworthy trends did you participate in during your misspent youth? There's got to be something. Any fashion faux pas or anything like that?
Oh my God. Yeah, there's tons of stuff. I think my freshman or sophomore year of college, I was wearing like a red leather jacket. Pleather, I don't know. It was like a thrift store find at some point. I think I got it for a costume or something. And I thought it was so cool. I probably should have just kept it at the thrift store. What else?
I, of course, love that idea, but that's just because you thrifted it, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't like an $8,000 like Valentino red leather jacket. Definitely it's not that. We're revisiting some of the Harry Potter movies with our kids, and I don't know if you're familiar, but I think it's the fourth one. They all have like super long hair, and it's like, oh, this is the one where nobody got a haircut for a year. I was like, oh yeah, I went through that phase too around 2004. Just like didn't get haircuts one or two a year. That was kind of it. Oh, those are the glory days.
You didn't have long hair for a little bit. Yeah.
But I have to say I have one very egregious one, super egregious. I think the year is probably like 1999. And I was friends with this guy and I thought, you know, he was like a year older than me. He was a good guy. And I thought he was pretty cool. And somehow he convinced me that I should like bleach my hair. So one day we just went and did it. Do you remember this or no?
Yes, I am having vague recollections of this.
So there's definitely like photos around when that happened, but it was definitely like a stupid teenager thing. But what made it like colossally stupid, galactically stupid, is that I did it probably like a month before I got my driver's license. So I had to look at that bad boy haircut for like 3 more years every time I pulled out my license.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny.
So there you go. How about you?
I mean,
anything that you look back on and be like, what the hell was going on there?
Well, as you know, I was not afraid to experiment with my look. Every time I look back at photos of me from the 90s, I'm always struck by just how absolutely enormous my clothes are. It's like I'm a good, you know, 40 pounds heavier than I was when I was in high school. And I don't think the clothes I wore in high school would actually fit me now, because not only did sizes run larger, but I would also buy a larger size. So so I'm always just struck by that when I look at old pictures, you know. And there were a few other things. You know, I dyed my hair orange in like a punk rock sort of stage. Frequented the thrift shops because I liked to find, you know, vintage clothes and stuff like this. And there must have been other people doing it, because if you recall, there was a time period when you could buy shirts at department stores or Target or whatever, and it would say things on it like, such and such company picnic, 1983. Well, I was going to the Salvation Army and finding those actual t-shirts and wearing them around. Right. Because I thought it was kind of like ironic and cool. I had a wallet chain for a while.
I remember that one.
Yeah, I had that for a while. That was a huge record. Maybe I was a tad too old to get invested in the emo scene. But was emo at all a part of your high school experience, or were you like just a hair too old for that? Did you know any emo kids?
Like, definitely the fashion and like the style were around. I mean, I'm sure that there was music, this emo style of music too, but I wasn't paying attention to it.
Right.
And like, this came out like right after, well, this is like when I'm like deep into like classical music. So like, I'm not really listening to any popular music at this point. You know, I'm listening to Otello and The Car and Tosca, you know, as I'm like going on runs and stuff. So I definitely didn't have this, but I will say this, if it had come out 5 years earlier when I was in high school, this probably would have been something right up my alley.
You think so, huh?
I think, yes, I do. Because it has enough like edge to it and a lot of like the rock punk elements that we've talked about a lot on this show that I really enjoy. And then they sneak in some emotions from time to time, which is always
well, they're
kind of fun.
They're not sneaking in the emotions either. They're kind of like knocking down your door.
I guess yeah. That's a better way to put it. They're, it's all over the place.
With that, what were your initial impressions of the album, Joe?
Well, I gotta tell you, I was like, I had heard of this group before, but I really had no real point of reference as far as their sound and their style, and but then like you put this album on and it like transports you back to like the early 2000s. It's like very much like it's like when sommeliers will tell you about like Burgundy in the year 1967. Oh, it was a vintage year. It's like, oh. And then they can just like, you know, they just pop open the bottle and they know exactly where it's from and when it was created. And I feel like this album has a bit of that of it, right? Like, if you were around back then, even if this was not your thing, if you started to listen to this, you would totally remember, oh, I can remember somebody in my high school who was seriously into My Chemical Romance at that point in time, you know?
Right, right.
But like the music itself, I thought it was a pretty cool idea how they put this album together, and in the time where there was a lot of teenage angst, you know, the early aughts after 9/11 and after Columbine, after all that stuff, it makes a lot of sense of why they created it and the style and what they were trying to do with it. You hear a lot of their musical influences throughout this, right? Like they opened for Green Day on one of their tours. You know, there's Queen, there's all sorts of stuff that when you hear it, you're like, oh, you guys must have listened to this stuff all the time, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, overall, I thought it was pretty well done. I have a couple of things that I want to talk through with you. Maybe you can convince me otherwise. but I thought, you know, generally speaking, it was pretty good. And I'm glad that we got to listen to it pretty quickly. What about you? What were your first thoughts for this one? Because I know we've talked about doing this one for a while now.
Yeah. I kind of had it on my mind. And then, you know, we went with our more seasonal episodes to you know, coincide with the holidays, and I was pretty impressed by this. I thought I would like it, and I remember enjoying a couple of singles by them, you know, back in the day, but I wasn't prepared for the sophistication of some of this music, and I think they showed a solid understanding of different musical forms and traditions, and they incorporate everything together in a way that feels cohesive to me. they do draw from a lot of different influences. You mentioned Queen for one. I hear elements of swing music, of Eastern European folk music, ragtime, and just like straightforward rock and roll stuff. So I found myself pretty engaged while I was listening to this. And, you know, the centerpiece of the album, and I think the song that we're specifically talking about when we talk about Queen's influence is basically the title track, Welcome to the Black Parade, that would feel right at home on a Queen album. Also kind of brought memories of like maybe Jim Steinman and Meatloaf a little bit too, which is kind of like the epic nature of it and the soaring vocals and stuff.
I had that written in my notes exactly as well.
yeah. But there's a lot going on with that song. And I think we need to talk about that one first before we get into some of the deeper tracks. So why don't you start us off? What did you think?
I really like this one, and I agree with everything you just said. You know, totally sounds like it could be on a Queen album. It's funny because the setup is, you know, the kid is talking to his father, and they're talking about at some point, you know, your life's gonna end, and that part is a little bit more restrained and quieter and intimate, and then we get into the parade itself, and it's like there's such a sense of urgency, which you don't always think like after death, is there urgency? I don't know. But musically it's pretty operatic. So, you know, I enjoyed that aspect of it. And though I had really many of these tracks that I'm pretty certain almost all of them I had never heard before, but this one, after I listened to it a few times, I was like, oh, I do kind of remember this refrain and the what they keep coming back to carry on. And, you know, I thought it was great. What about you?
It's definitely a great centerpiece to the album. And I kind of skipped over the part of the show where we give a little bit of background, but it's a pretty good opportunity to do that. So the album itself is, you know, the dirty word, concept album, and it centers around the character of the patient, as they call it, and it's about his passage out of life and the memories he has of it. In this song, death is coming for him in the form of a parade, and this is based on singer Gerard Way's notion of death appearing to a person in the form of their fondest memory. Which I think is such a freaking cool idea. Yeah, I mean, this is a great song, and it's just got so much going on. And they definitely like empty out the toolbox.
Yeah.
And they use a lot of elements that were pretty rare in songs at the time, and I think are even more rare in newer music, because we've got tempo changes, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple key changes.
Yeah, there's key changes. Absolutely. Nobody changes keys in songs anymore. And like the halftime groove that they're doing at the end is just awesome, like nailing the, you know, kind of the musical points home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really fun ride. And you have these very dense verses lyrically.
Yeah.
But then you have an anthemic chorus that, you know, as you pointed out in our summer playlist episode, you know, if you get, you know, 30-40% of the words right when they're singing fast, that's good enough. And then you can just like belt the chorus.
Yeah.
And as a bonus, it features a bit of glockenspiel at the beginning, and I wonder.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I wonder if that's a nod to fellow New Jersey native Bruce Springsteen, because My Chemical Romance is from New Jersey.
Yeah, yeah. Could be.
But yeah, but it's a great song, and it's a throwback to those like 70s epic story songs that we mentioned in previous episodes. So it's an easy song to like, for sure.
For sure.
Any others make any positive impressions on you?
So I would say that was probably my favorite. A couple of others that I really enjoyed. Well, the first one I think is right up your alley, and that's Dead, and that's the second track on the album. I feel like some of those, some of the rhythmic elements and definitely some of the guitar playing, I'm like, oh, like this is like metal light. Like it's not really metal, but like you have that kind of feeling to it. And like in preparing for this episode, I was watching a couple clips of them in concert, and like people go crazy when they start to play this one. And I read also this somehow also made it onto Guitar Hero, the video game. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
The other ones, which I think, you know, we might get there, but you mentioned it earlier, House of Wolves, it starts with that rock and swing beat, which is just so fun and really kind of a creek. It's a great idea of a way to open a song. And it definitely, at some points, some of these tracks start to blend together, which is not good or bad. It's just how it sounds. This one like abruptly jolts you into like a new groove and a new sound. So those were the ones that really I liked. I liked the best. What about you? What were some of the other ones that you really liked?
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed House of Wolves. And you're right, that drum part is on the toms is straight out of Sing 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 by Louis Prima.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of horns, you've got guitars. I want to talk about a song that I don't know if I would listen to all the time because it's a fucking trip and it's not a good trip.
Yeah.
And that's the song Mama.
Yeah.
Because it's that type of music just has a very distinct syncopated rhythm. I think it's in a minor key.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another song where it's got a couple of like these halftime sort of sections or like sections where they really slow it down. And it reminds me of like if you do watch people doing like that type of traditional Eastern European music. It's like you have that slow section that gradually, incrementally speeds up faster and faster until it's like total chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was just like a really smart way of using a traditional style and making it their own. The reason that I might not listen to it all the time is because the subject matter is very heavy. It kind of seems like there's this... the speaker of the song is the son like expressing resentment about going off to war and talking about like trying to connect to his mother who is estranged for some reason.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then the real kicker is at the end when who should make an appearance as Mama but Liza fucking Minnelli.
Yeah.
So like that was a really... totally unexpected and just very creative on their part. You know, mention maybe a couple of others briefly. The song Teenagers has kind of a fun, like dark sense of humor to it.
Oh, I didn't enjoy that one.
You did not enjoy that one.
No.
I just kind of like the dark sense of humor to it. And one of the reasons I wanted to watch this, or not watch, one of the reasons I wanted to listen to this album was because, you know, as things are coming up on my Instagram, whatever, and somebody who has a music page pointed out that the that the chord changes are very similar to a ragtime song. Mm. And then he actually like re-recorded it as a ragtime song, because like the emphasis on in the rhythms would be a little bit different if it was actually ragtime. Sure. I also like the song Sleep, because it's just, that's more of like a straight ahead rock song, and he's really like stretching himself the Gerard Way is stretching himself vocally on that song. I didn't think there were like any real stinkers on this, but you obviously have a different opinion, so I'm interested.
I wouldn't say stinkers, but like two that kind of popped out to me that I, you know, tell me if I'm wrong. Cancer is like the like emo power ballad, and I'm just like, yeah, I don't need to listen to this one again.
Right.
Like, okay, we get it. And then the second one, and this is kind of my like larger gripe across most of this album, is that, you know, I Don't Love You, gosh, that sounds like so much like a Green Day song. And it kind of bothers me, because the one, like, my big criticism with this is that it sounds like they are very much influenced by a lot of the folks that are already stated. They've, you know, had these influences. And my thing is, of course, we always have people and artists who influence us, but then we have to put our own spin on it. And I feel like this is a classic example of not, it's almost like mimicry. It's a photocopy, and there's not enough of their own sound in that particular track. And I think they get away with putting their own sort of lens on a lot of the sounds that they're adopting throughout the album. But that one for me, it's just like, and I get it. You probably idolize Green Day and you like the way that they sound, but that one is I thought was a little bit weaker than the rest of them.
Right. Yeah, Cancer, I could see why you wouldn't want to listen to that. I mean, I think in their eyes, that piece is integral to the story of the patient,
sure.
but it's not anything that you really want to listen to. I agree with you about I Don't Love You. And it does have, you're right, it does have American Idiot era Green Day written all over it.
Yeah.
I also kind of thought, like, with very few adjustments, this could have been recorded by, like, Kelly Clarkson or someone like that. Because it is a pretty straightforward ballad. I mean, yeah. The lyrics are maybe not as, you know, boilerplate balladry as you might hear, but musically it's it does stand out as something that's kind of just more banal and not, you know, they're not taking risks. I personally didn't have any problems, so to speak, with the songs, but there is something that I noticed that is kind of like an overall criticism, and I think that one of the barriers of people getting into this band and like recognizing them for their creativity and their songwriting and stuff, and maybe emo music in general, is the vocals.
Mm.
And I don't have a problem with them, but I think one of the most distinctive features of the genre are the vocals, which are usually like very bright, very nasal, and I would say like purposely sounding strained.
Yeah.
To evoke that emotion or to express the emotions that they're trying to express. And I think it's supposed to sound more genuine that way, because it's kind of singing loud and singing high without a lot of like gloss or pretense on it. I think that that type of like intense earnestness is a turnoff for some people who think it's too dramatic. But my problem is not the way it sounds. My problem is that it's bad technique.
Well, I think the way that you described it was the original intention of this style, where it's, you know, you're just unabashedly sharing your emotions through your voice, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to sound how it's going to sound. And but somewhere along the way, to me, and I don't know a whole lot about this genre, but what I do know is that the vocal singing almost became like a caricature of itself and not like individual to each lead singer.
Right.
And when you get to that point, it's kind of like, all right, what are we really doing? Now it's kind of irritating because you're all trying to sing in this very specific way that you may or may not do to varying levels of success. But then it's just like, it just becomes homogenous and you don't get like those little individual choices.
Right, right. It's like they're all having a contest to see who can be the best version of a particular aesthetic instead of just doing their thing.
Yeah.
And like you, I did watch a few of their live performances and, you know, it's kind of like taking note of the singing. And nothing on the album sounds bad vocally. I think it's like serving its purpose well for the genre, but I'm just listening to him and I'm like, I wonder how this guy sounds live, because he does some, you know, he does some pretty challenging stuff. And, you know, I've watched a couple of live performances and there are times when Gerard Way sounds good. And there are other times where he has to sing certain lines an octave down.
Yeah.
Which, when you're doing a 138 show tour, maybe you got to do that to save yourself for the long haul. But it does rob the songs of some of their punch. And then there are other times where he just kind of like crashes and burns because he's singing all with his throat. It doesn't sound supported.
Yeah.
Well, and that's just not sustainable.
And he's singing like two word phrases, right? Because he has to breathe constantly because it's not supported.
Yeah, there's a little of that, and then there's a little like on some of the faster stuff, there's a little bit more of like talk singing or just like yelling, which can work if you're doing it in a purposeful way, particularly in a music genre that's influenced by punk. But you just wonder like how much of it is purposeful and how much of it is just like flat out fatigue.
Right.
That's just my two cents on that.
Well, the last comment I'll make on this specific topic is, I did listen to Welcome to the Black Parade that they did for SNL, and it was right when the album came out. And that's it's a difficult song. It's long and it's pretty high. And I guess they kind of had to do it because that was like, I think, basically like the big hit from this album. I think Teenagers did pretty well as well, too. But that was obviously, it's essentially the title track. And it did not go well. it was not very good. That's what happens with live music. So,
right. Yeah, I'll have to check that one out because the live performance of that song that I watched was on their world tour, and it was in a stadium, and I would say like it was okay, like it was passable. He also didn't go for some of the higher stuff.
Sure.
You know, especially like in those slower sections, they're so full of words and they're so high. Yeah, he definitely didn't chance it.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on this record?
The execution of the concept album, I give them, they did a great job at that. And I think they made a lot of good choices and the sequencing is perfect. And, you know, it all really works well together and telling that story that they want to tell. You know, this is a genre, again, I have not spent a ton of time with, but it was kind of fun to dive into it a little bit more and really pick out those key elements that, you know, when you hear this style of music, you know what it is, but then to be able to identify those specific things like, oh, you're borrowing from punk and then you're borrowing from like 70s rock and you're, you know, doing all these things. It's like, oh, okay, I get it. It's not always for, it's definitely not for me now. Maybe at one point in my life, this was music was written for me. But, you know, I appreciate that. I would say that you do kind of have to take this thing all at once. It doesn't really work. Like, I don't think I would probably excerpt one of these songs and put them somewhere. Well, it doesn't work because that's not what they wanted you to do. But besides that, you know, I thought generally it was really, really well done and well put together. And, you know, we talked about things we didn't like and that's okay. But I thought, you know, for this style and in the early 2000s, this is pretty, pretty great. What about you? Yeah. What are your final thoughts?
So my final thoughts kind of are on a more macro level.
Mm-hmm.
And it just got me thinking about how in every little rock subgenre that develops, whether it's grunge or hair metal or emo, there are bands that kind of fit the aesthetic and check all the style boxes that are mm-hmm. easy to check. And then there are bands that may fit those style characteristics and may, you know, just by happenstance come up in a particular sure. scene, but they're also creative and they're musically literate beyond that particular scene. And I think My Chemical Romance fits into that latter category, at least with this
mm-hmm.
album.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an album, you know, full of enough interesting stuff that I liked it more each time I listened to it. And then just in general about emo, I feel like emo was just a convenient whipping boy to dismiss the younger generation in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just kind of what old folks tend to do to young folks when they see that their cultural capital is waning.
Right, right.
I mean, it's happening now when maybe people our age complain about TikTok. But, you know, so I feel like that's, you know, kind of emblematic of that thing that kind of happens to all generations. But that's another topic for another podcast.
Absolutely.
All right. So we definitely appreciate you listeners coming to us in 2023 and continuing this journey with us. And just want to remind everyone to make sure that you're following us on Instagram so that you can see what we're up to and so that you can see what's coming up on some future episodes. And thanks again for listening. Brothers in Song is written and produced by Joseph Collin and Daniel Collin, and edited by Daniel Collin. To keep up with the latest news, follow us on Instagram at Brothers in Song. Until next time, listen to some new music. You just may surprise yourself.